Hi, podcasters. This is Andy Studna, editor of Applied Clinical Trials, and I'm here today with our editor-in-chief, Lisa Henderson. For today's episode, we are speaking with Peter Benton, president, co-CEO, and board member of Worldwide Clinical Trials.
In his current role, Peter leads a team of over 3,000 people in 60 countries whose mission is to develop therapies by integrating clinical trials methodology and technology. Peter's career didn't begin in pharma. His mechanical engineering degree found him first in GE, then in the automotive industry before entering J&J. From there, he moved to BioClinica as president of the eClinical Services Division. So thank you for joining us today, Peter.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Yes, thank you, Peter. I want to start off with, you know, Lisa just gave a brief overview of some of your experience, but can you provide a highlighted version of your career journey for us?
Sure. I think I've had a very atypical career journey in our industry. So I began my career as an engineer. I have a degree in mechanical engineering from Northeastern in Boston, and I worked as a weapons designer for the Department of Defense. My background was in kind of specialty materials, fiberglass, composites, and others. And at the time, Ronald Reagan was president and began closing down bases. So I switched industries and went to work for a company called General Electric and during the Jack Welch days of GE. And from there went on to, I worked on helicopter engines, tank transmissions, nuclear guidance programs, industrial motors, and a whole host of other kind of manufacturing type businesses. It took me all over the globe. And then went to work for a company called TRW in the automotive industry. So I then went to work on automotive electronics, remote keyless entry, airbags, seatbelts, steering wheels, and all sorts of other devices. And then I decided that I wanted to switch industries, and I focused on industries that were large and potentially needed to be restructured, and really kind of narrowed my choices down to the telecommunications industry and the pharmaceutical industry. And I'm still shocked today at how far the telecom industry has changed. For those of us that remember Mother Bell, and there was one single telephone company, to today, where we've gone with telephones and cell phones and Android and iPhones, et cetera. And literally the whole industry was kind of blown apart through government regulation into smaller pieces, and it's kind of been rebuilt and reconfigured. But the pharmaceutical industry that I joined back in 2001, we still pretty much operate the same way. There's lots of innovation, there's lots of change, but the core fundamental business is still the same as it was back then.
That's really interesting. So before I get to why you may have stayed in pharmaceuticals, what are your thoughts for why it hasn't changed? Or do you think it needs to be changed? And as you say, like kind of blown apart, like the telecom industry has.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of things that I've learned are similar and different because I've worked in so many different industries. And the reason that J&J, now Janssen, was looking to hire me was because of my background in other industries. So what costs $1 billion and takes 10 years to get to market, right? When I say that, everyone in the drug development industry starts thinking drug development. Well, everyone building the Boeing Dreamliner thinks it's a new airplane. Everybody building a nuclear missile thinks it's a new weapon system. Everybody launching a new car brand thinks it's a car brand. And so there's a lot of things that cost $1 billion and take 10 years to get to market. But the drugs and the treatments that we're developing, they're going into our human bodies, right? They're going into our children. They're going into our grandchildren. They're going into our loved ones. And so a couple things that are different is just the severity of what can possibly happen. Again, I'm not downplaying the importance of an airbag being well designed and tested, or a seatbelt or something else. Those all protect our lives too. But, you know, these are chemical or biological mechanisms that are going to be ingested into our body or injected into our body or medical device installed into our body. So it's really, really critical that we get this right. So I think that's one of the big things. The other change is those other products always get to market, right? The Boeing Dreamliner had all sorts of battery problems and issues that had to be redesigned. It's continued to have control and other issues, but you know, they're not going to cancel the whole program. I remember the new Corvette launch a couple of years ago. I think they, at the end of the day, they ran out of time and they just glued on some Camaro taillights to the car. So I don't, you know, I think there's some things that they forgot, but you know, you can't really launch the 2024 Corvette in 2028, right? You've got to launch it on time. So other industries, you know, have to launch their product. It may require more money, more time, et cetera. But in our industry, if you have side effects or the drug starts to interact with a liver or kidney or heart or something else, these programs stop. I mean, they stop full tilt. And so you can spend hundreds of millions of dollars in drug development and realize, you know, this is not safe for a human to, even depending on the treatment. And there may be great results with the drug, but the risks are just too high. And I think that's the piece that really makes this industry different than all those other industries I've worked in. And just, you know, I'm not sure we can afford to really be too radical in how we change the business.
Really good point. So you were hired into J&J. Was that based on your mechanical and all of your executive management experience? What did you come into J&J as?
I joined as a vice president in kind of project portfolio resource management. So, you know, I have a lot of expertise managing things, organizing things, doing process improvement, Six Sigma, Black Belt, et cetera. And so, you know, that experience was really all around how do we manage drug development? What kind of Gantt charts do we need to have? How can we do resource forecasting? You know, I wasn't there for toxicology or drug metabolism or anything else, but how do I bring a kind of business mindset to, at the time, a company with, you know, multiple acquisitions and different divisions? And again, the work that Centocor is doing is different than Alza, is different than Janssen, different than PRI, different than Tibotec, Sios, et cetera. They're all, you know, there's differences and nuances to all of them, but they really require, you know, good project management. If someone's got to be able to forecast what the costs are going to be and the timelines are going to be and those other pieces. So that was where I was hired in to help figure that out.
So what made you stay in the drug development clinical trials space?
You know, it was a big change coming into the industry, the nomenclature, the vocabulary. But I mean, it was not only fascinating, but within a couple of years, I was able to get, you know, my father special dispensation to get one of the drug-coated stents from J&J. You know, he was having some cardiac issues, so was able to do that. Many years after that, he spent about 12 years fighting Alzheimer's and died about 2 years ago. And I just, all the work that we do, whether it's Alzheimer's, which has certainly hit very close to home, or more importantly, with two daughters, you know, some of these rare orphan indications with children who are inflicted with a disease that, you know, they may not live to their 20s or 30s. I really love what I do. Again, working on a nuclear guidance program, I can convince some people that that's a good thing for people all over the world and that the U.S. needs to not only protect itself, but other countries who can't protect themselves. But I don't know anybody. I don't care if they vote left, right, middle, outer space, wherever. It doesn't matter who you are or where you are. You know, helping cure diseases and helping sick people and helping people with terrible debilitating causes. I can't think of anything I'd rather do for the rest of my life.
Thank you, Peter. And thank you for sharing that about your family too. So now, how has the clinical trials industry changed in the past 20 years?
You know, one, I've realized that I have more of a chance to change the industry, you know, from the services side. You know, I absolutely believe that I've made a bigger impact on companies. You know, when I worked for a large pharmaceutical company, I think I've had more impact on how drug development should be done and can be done, and have impacted the way we do things more as an outsider, as a service provider. I can remember saying I never wanted to work for a CRO and I never wanted to live in North Carolina, both of which, you know, came to be true. But I really believe both my experience, you know, on the clinical side at what was eTrials, Merge, IBM, and BioClinica, and now here at Worldwide, that you know, we really can make a difference. And innovations that we bring to how we can speed up and get drugs to market faster and quicker and more reliably are really, really important. But the really big thing is just the emergence of the biotech space, right? The emerging to mid-size pharmaceutical and biotech companies, they are going to overtake the amount of innovation that's coming from the large pharmaceutical companies that are out there. And so I've kind of joked with some folks about if you just go to the Boston area, Cambridge is certainly well known as a biotech hub, and Seaport is, you know, up and coming. There's lots of new companies there. But I've been in Waltham at a customer before, and I got lost on my way to Starbucks, and I found six biotech companies on the way there. And so, you know, Waltham is the suburbs of Cambridge and the suburbs, the biotech community. But I am convinced that if the three of us just got dropped any place in Waltham and started walking in different directions, we're going to find new companies we've never heard of. And you don't even need to walk a block in Cambridge to go find new biotech companies. But, you know, having grown up in Boston, there are biotech companies in Worcester now, right? And there's not much out there other than the WooSox, which for all of you Red Sox fans is the minor league team has moved from Providence to Worcester. But, you know, there's a biotech community. It's really spreading. And I just think the amount of these new companies is way beyond the comprehension of most people in our industry. And I'm really, you know, I'm encouraged by that. Again, lots of bets being placed on lots of different companies in lots of different areas, but there's absolutely going to be some really fantastic developments coming out of these companies, and those numbers continue to grow every single day. So I'm encouraged by how many great things are coming our way for the next generation of people that are growing up.
Really good points. So when you talk about innovation and the biotechs, clearly the scientific innovation and the speed of the innovation, actually, you know, with these therapies. But as a service provider, as you said, you felt like you could make a bigger impact. So what types of changes, either at Worldwide or in the industry itself, do you see impacting, as you say, how drug development should be done in the next few years?
I think the speed at which we make decisions and get the right information to make those decisions, consistently seen in, you know, I've now been in this industry longer than any other, but, you know, over the last 20 plus years, you know, I just think we've got so much better access to information, ability to visualize information, ability to really grasp and understand the impact of the data that we're getting from these trials. And back when I started in the industry, and even still today, one of the number one things that I see that slows clinical trials down, it's not enrollment, it's not a recruitment. Yes, those are difficult, but it's really just making decisions and moving as fast as possible. You know, and we still, again, these are choosing who's going to run your trial for you, choosing the way in which you're going to run your trial, you know, developing the protocol, the schedule events, all the pieces that go into it, data management plans, all of these things require a lot of effort. But, you know, the faster we can make those decisions and get things moving along, that really speeds up the industry. And so I don't think it's anything miraculous. You know, certainly some of the direct participants, you know, and sightless-based techniques are interesting, and we will certainly adapt. But we've taken us 15 years to get risk-based monitoring in place, really, as a standard, and I'm still not sure it's fully standardized. So, you know, we're making progress, but we still have an awful lot of caution and hesitation that I think slows down the overall process. So it's kind of simple, but, you know, really building good partnerships with our customers and our partners, and really helping them make sure they have all the right data as fast as possible in order to make those decisions to get to the next step in the process is really, really important.
Thank you, Peter. Now, as an executive, what keeps you up at night running your company?
Number one is hackers. That's been number one for a while. I'm terrified of one person being fooled by someone in a phishing campaign and giving access to God forbid, financial accounts, but even worse, you know, access to our partners' information. You know, that's something that continues to scare me because I get people try and fish me all the time. I think most of my employees now know I will never ask them to go get Google gift cards and give me the PIN numbers, et cetera, right? You know, we reiterate that. So I continue to be worried about that. And again, there's a lot of critical things we're doing. There's a lot of valuable information that our industry holds that shouldn't get out there and into the public until it's time. But the other thing is, as I've seen worldwide grow, you know, from over the last now almost 9 years, is becoming big and bureaucratic. I mean, I've worked for large companies. I've worked for General Electric. It was still a very nimble company in the Jack Welch days. I've worked for TRW. I've worked for J&J. And so, you know, having worked for three large companies, I know what I love about those companies, and I also know what I hate about those companies. And, you know, I don't ever want an employee to feel like they're a number. I don't ever want a customer to feel like they're one of many customers. We really strive to try and make each customer feel like they're the only one and make sure that our employees feel like they're truly honored, valued member of our team. And so making sure that we don't create a lot of bureaucracy. I'm on a current, I wouldn't call it a witch hunt, but I'm really trying to get rid of acronyms, right? We are probably an industry that I don't know why we love acronyms so well, but there are so many three-letter, four-letter, abbreviated names that we like to use for things, and that kind of drives me crazy. So, you know, trying to actually just call things what they are. But as we grow, that's really how I've got to ensure the worldwide team's success, is that we continue to stay entrepreneurial and nimble and customer focused. And I repeat those messages to our employees all the time. And I don't just mean our external customers, but our internal customers also. So whether it's data management or pharmacovigilance or project management, you know, we all need to treat each other not just as colleagues, but we're all partners in this endeavor together, and making sure that we're all asking for feedback and gathering feedback about how we're individually and as departments doing, that's really, really important. So.
Excellent. So I'm with you on the acronym thing. Andy knows that. I'm always like, get it out of the text. Just spell it. So.
Well, and they mean the same. I mean, they mean something different to someone in quality versus someone in HR versus someone in operations versus someone in finance. EPS is one that came up recently. And again, finance is talking about earnings per share, and I forgot there what the people team was. It was the employee payroll something. I mean, but we all have a different meaning in our head. And sometimes people talk fast and you have no idea what they're talking about.
Exactly. I'm with you on that. So clinical trials professionals, I was going to ask you what advice you would give. Now, granted, it's a huge horizontal industry also with a lot of depth, but what advice would you give people in the industry right now?
I've got a couple pieces of advice. And I think first from an industry perspective, Mike McKelvey gave me some advice or comment many years ago, and someone I really respect. And he said, we're all getting older, which means we're going to have more medical treatments and we're going to take more drugs. And the more medical care and drugs we take, the older we get. He's like, do you understand where this is going, Peter? And I'm like, I absolutely get where it's going. And so, again, I've got a couple daughters expecting to have some grandchildren maybe one of these days. They will live to be 130 years old. And so, you know, at 130 years old, you think about how different life is going to be. You don't need 10 houses. You don't need 4,000 suits. You don't need to eat twice as much as you eat today. And so when you think about the future, you know, we don't need to spend more money on houses, clothing, food, cars, et cetera, right? Now, again, they're going to evolve. They're going to change. We're going to have inflation, but our wages will go up. But you're going to spend a lot more money on your healthcare. That is absolutely inevitable, and we're going to be older. And so that's going to happen. Now, again, we've got to be more efficient because we can't afford to spend 80% of our income on healthcare. So we've got to figure out better ways of treating some of these diseases. So from a macro perspective, there's few better industries to be in than in the healthcare business. I just absolutely convinced this is a fantastic place to be for the business reasons. Forget about the fact that you're doing good things and helping people out. So that's fantastic. But I think there's going to be so much change also. And I don't know how much of the human body we figured out. I don't know if it's 10%. I don't know if it's 15%. But the thing that has changed so much since I joined over 20 years ago is we were treating symptoms of diseases, and now we're literally treating the diseases, right? We're treating diseases at the cellular level. We're treating diseases at the molecular level. We learned so much about genetics and gene editing, gene splicing, gene munching. There's just some fantastic treatments. We're just at the precipice of understanding even more about each of these individual areas and then how they all act together in a systemic approach. So the future is just absolutely fantastic. And I can remember some debates well over 20 years ago about, I'm not sure if we're running out of diseases that we should treat, or are we running out of drugs that we can use to treat those diseases? Well, I can tell you that both of those we don't need to worry about, because the more we learn, as Dr. Murphy from our team says, we are orphanizing and rarefying every single disease area. And so it's no longer just, you know, we've got cholesterol and a couple other big key areas for blockbuster drugs, right? I remember the days of Lipitor when that launched. You know, we are breaking diseases down into smaller and smaller subsets and, you know, literally finding smaller patient populations, truly, truly getting to the point of personalized medicine that we've talked about again for 15, 20 years. So I just think there are so many great opportunities, but everything is going to be orphan and rare eventually. So, you know, having expertise in small niche areas and being able to move quick and fast in those areas, I think that's great career advice. Getting as much experience as many different things. It's not, you know, I wouldn't recommend going out and working in nuclear missiles and the automotive industry as a precursor to pharma. But I am convinced that, you know, the more you learn, the more companies you work for, the greater your experience will be. But, you know, it's a great industry. We do fantastic things. And there are so many career opportunities that are just going to continue to expand.
Excellent advice. You don't recommend getting into the automotive industry, right?
I took me a while to go get my MBA, but you know, when I was there, we were a $20 billion automotive supplier, and we made 6 or 7% profit before tax. So it's just it's a brutal yeah. business. I mean, the car companies have so much left. So mm-hmm. I just, you know, it was a tough industry to be in. Again, it's absolutely critical, but you know, and again. Yeah. We're going to move to electric cars. I mean, it's a matter of time. But eventually, one of my daughters doesn't even like driving. One loves to drive, one hates to drive. But, you know, robotic Uber electric cars that drive around and deliver us to where it is, like, it's coming. I don't know how long, but that's inevitable also. So
excellent. Well, thank you for sharing your views and your experiences for the audience. We really appreciate it, Peter.
Yeah, thank you. I thoroughly enjoyed it.